Hello, this is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of Atid. I am sitting here today with Rabbi Chaim Bravender, president of Atid, and Rabbi Yedidia Julian Sinclair, and we're talking about Rav Kook's relationship to art. We hope that this will be the first of a number of discussions and learning sessions. We'll be looking at some of Rav Kook's writings and perhaps at a future point other great Jewish thinkers, teachers, and leaders, and what they have to say about engagement with art, the plastic arts, the creative arts in general. Today we are looking at a section from Rav Kook's Orot HaKodesh in the third volume. Rabbi Sinclair, why don't you tell us a little bit about generally Rav Kook's relationship to art and the particular text we'll be looking at today in specific.
Thank you, Rabbi Sachs. Rav Kook's approach to art was, as far as I can see, unique amongst Orthodox Jewish thinkers of any stature. For Rav Kook, art, and indeed other artistic media, for example poetry, literature, creative writing, music, were not just desirable pursuits, but actually ways in which one could pursue a vocation. Ways in which a person with any talent or inclination towards these media could actually come close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And what I like to try and understand in these conversations is how it was that Rav Kook was able to come to this view. What was it in his thought which allowed him to legitimate art and other creative pursuits, whereas other Orthodox thinkers, including thinkers who wanted to engage the secular world in different ways, generally didn't legitimate art in this way. I'd like to start today talking about and looking at some pages from Orot HaKodesh, volume 3, in which Rav Kook discusses the question of individuality, and particularly the obligation, I don't think that's too strong a word, the obligation that Rav Kook saw first to endeavor to realize and express in the world each of our unique individualities. What's this got to do with art, you might think? Well, actually I think that it's quite fundamental for understanding Rav Kook's approach to art. To help understand why, I'd like, if I may, to read a couple of paragraphs from a book that I found called The Ethics of Authenticity by a Canadian philosopher called Charles Taylor, in which he discusses many of the issues that Rav Kook's dealing with, but from a secular perspective. This is what he says. The notion that each one of us has an original way of being human entails that each of us has to discover what it is to be ourselves. But the discovery can't be made by consulting pre-existing models by hypothesis. So it can be made only by articulating it afresh. We discover what we have it in us to be by becoming that mode of life, by giving expression in our speech and action to what is original in us. The notion that revelation comes through expression is what I want to capture in speaking of the expressivism of the modern notion of the individual. This suggests right away a close analogy, even a connection, between self-discovery and artistic creation. With Herder, German thinker of the 19th century, and the expressivist understanding of human life, the relation becomes very intimate. Artistic creation becomes the paradigm mode in which people can come to self-definition. The artist becomes in some way the paradigm case of the human being as agent of original self-definition. Since about 1800, there has been a tendency to heroize the artist, to see in his or her life the essence of the human condition, and to venerate him or her as a seer, the creator of cultural values. But of course, along with this has gone a new understanding of art in the last 200 years or so. No longer defined mainly by imitation, by mimesis of reality, art is understood now more in terms of creation. These two ideas go together. If we become ourselves by expressing what we're about, and if what we become is by hypothesis original, not based on the pre-existing, then what we express is not an imitation of the pre-existing either, but a new creation. We think of the imagination as creative. When we describe the lives of non-artists in creative terms, in artistic terms, this matches our tendency to consider artists as somehow paradigm achievers of self-definition. So what I want to say by bringing that text is that in the, certainly the 19th century culture, which Ralph Cook was very aware of and out of which he was writing, it would be considered axiomatic that realizing one's uniqueness in the world is intimately connected with art. The artists are the people who do that in the most pronounced and admirable way. We may or may not share that understanding of art, but I think that was certainly how it seemed to the people for whom Ralph Cook was writing. And so that's why I'd like to start our discussion of Ralph Cook's view on art with this issue of how he dealt with the problem of individuality and individual self-realization. Let's look at the first of Ralph Cook's texts, which I want us to read. I don't suggest that Ralph Cook is necessarily writing about American high school students, but let's try and understand what he's saying and see if there's anything of relevance here for today's practitioners of Jewish education. Okay? Yeah?
Maybe so.
So, let's look at Bakashat Ha'ani Ha'atzmi, page Kuf Mem in the Ohr Kodesh Gimel. Just another word of warning, I am writing a doctorate in Rav Cook, but to me, a doctorate in Ralph Cook doesn't mean any certificate of mastery over the material. It just means you've got your foot on the bottom rung of the ladder. So if there's something you ask me what it means and I don't know, then ask me again in 30 years. Va'ani b'toch ha'gola. I am in exile. Ha'ani ha'pnimi ha'atzmi shel ha'yachid v'shel ha'tzibur Eino mitgale b'toch yoto, rak lefi erech hakadusha v'hatorah shelo. So to translate first and then to explain afterwards, the inner individual I, both of the individual and of the community, is not revealed in its inwardness except according to the degree of holiness and purity which is in it. To explain the last bit first, it's not revealed in its holiness and purity it's not revealed in its inwardness except according to the degree of holiness and purity in it. Well, Cook, as we shall see, believed that individuality comes from a connection with the source of Kedusha v'Tahara, spiritual religious life. He thinks that evil cannot be original. Evil is imitative in different ways, but individuality is rooted in the source of holiness. You can agree with that or not, but that was Ralph Cook's view. Let's go back to the first words. Ani b'toch ha'gola. That, of course, is a quote from the beginning of Sefer Yechezkel. Yechezkel begins Sefer Yechezkel by saying, Ani b'an b'toch ha'gola. He was sitting in Bavel, and he introduces the direct revelation of the Merkava, which he's about to experience with those words. Ralph Cook is using that in a punning way. It's not just saying I am in exile, but the I. the I. And presumably he means the individual I-ness of each person and of the community, we'll see later what he means by that, is in exile. Some sense, the individual and the community are not connected with their essential selfhood. But the phrase "ani b'tocha gola" is also a quote from the Zohar Kadosh on in volume 1, page 6a of the Zohar. The Zohar brings this quote from Yechezkel and explains it. "Va'ani b'tocha gola, dagat ha'ani," the Zohar says, "is b'gola. The level of I is in the gola." I wouldn't have probably found this except for the fact that it's right at the very beginning of the Zohar, so I didn't get much further than that in my reading, but far enough to find this, that this is the source for Rav Cook's reading. The commentary of the Sulam on the Zohar there says that Dargat Ha'ani, that means the Sphira of Malchut. I don't know how the Sulam knows that, but apparently Rav Cook knew that also, because in other places in this chapter he identifies the Ani that he's interested in with the Sphira of Malchut. And what that means, apparently, from other places where he makes this identification, is the capacity to receive. That Malchut is the lowest of the 10 Sphirot, and that into which the spiritual energies of the other Sphirot flow is the receptacle which is called a Sphira of Malchut. Again, I'm not a great expert in this, but that's what I gleaned from this chapter and the basic books on Kabbalah, which anyone can read. So, the I-ness is in exile, and it's revealed, Rav Cook says, "Lefi erech hagvura ha'elyona, hasfuga meha'ora ha'ora ha'tohora shel ziv ha'mala shi mitlahevet bekirbo." It's revealed according to. Now these phrases, Hakvura Ha'elyona, that is code in Rav Cook for the Sphira of Bina, and the Ziv HaMala, I believe, refers to the Keter of the Sphira of Keter, and that I can't say that I'm confident to explain. So, if you don't mind, we'll just go on. Rav Cook says, "Chatanu im avotenu chet Adam harishon." We have sinned with our fathers, the sin of Adam HaRishon, who became strange, became alien to his selfness. So now, Rav Cook is going on to explain, and this idea of being true to oneself, in terms of some of the most basic and elemental stories of the Tanakh, starting first of all with the Chet of Adam HaRishon. Adam Rishon's problem, he says, was he became strange, alien to himself. How? Shepana ledato shel hanachash. He turned towards the opinion of the snake. In other words, he wanted to know what to do about this piece of fruit which his wife was offering him. He turned to the snake, and the snake said, "Snake, what do you think?" And that was his basic mistake, according to Rav Cook. Because in doing so, Avadid Atzmol, he lost himself. Adam HaRishon, apparently, according to Rav Cook, should have answered this question, what to do about the fruit, by turning inwards to source of knowledge inside him, and figuring out on that basis what to do. Lo yada lahashiv tshuva brura al she'elat ayeka. And therefore, when God comes and asks him, "Ayeka, where are you?" he doesn't know what to say. Because, in Rav Cook's reading, where are you, that God is asking? And he doesn't know, because he lost himself. Mipnei shelo yada nafsho, because he didn't know himself. Mipnei she'aniyut ha'amitit ne'avda mimenu. Bechet she'hishtachaveh le'elza. Because his I, his real I, his selfness, had been lost from him, through the sin of, so to speak, bowing down to a strange god. Well, Adam HaRishon no longer knew who he was. He'd lost connection with himself by turning to the snake and asking the snake what to do. It was all over for him at that point. And Rav Kook goes on and says, Chata Yisrael zana acharei Elohei Nehe et aniyut atzmit azav zana Yisrael toh. So now Rav Kook is interpreting this theme of his of losing one's selfness in terms of the basic chait of Avodah Zarah. That's what Israel were doing when they sinned with Avodah Zarah, Rav Kook say, turning away from what was true for them, the worship which was appropriate to them, and turning to other sources. Chata ha'aretz hechshicha et atzmiota tzimtzama et chela halcha achrei megamot v'tachlitot lo natna et kol chela hakamus liyot tam et katam peryo. And concomitantly with that, Rav Kook says the land sinned, it denied itselfness, its selfhood, therefore its strength was contracted, went after other tendencies, wasn't able to give its full hidden force, such that its the taste of its fruit would be like the taste of the tree itself. So reference to the midrash on Parshat Bereshit, that originally the taste of the tree was the same as the taste of the fruit, and the Rav Kook, that's an image which he uses a couple of times to describe some state of primal authenticity or connection which has been lost. Nasa ayin michutzla, she, I think the land in this context, raised her eyes to that which is outside her, lechshov al davar goralot v'karirot, to think of matters of literally fates or destinies and careers. These I think were words which were common terms of almost of abuse in the early days of Zionism, goralot v'karirot. And careerism was a cardinal sin in the early days of classical Zionism, not like today. It meant, you know, being concerned with your position and your rung in the hierarchy and your place on the party ladder and all those things which weren't really essential to realizing the Zionist ideal.
Do we know when Rav Kook was writing this?
Not exactly. Most probably sometime between 1904 and 1914.
So it was only published in the 60s.
This was actually published in the 30s. The Orah HaKodesh, which we're reading, was edited from Rav Kook's notebooks, which are called known today as the Shmona Kvatzim, by his leading student, Rav David HaKohen, the Nazir. And they were put out around the time of and shortly after Rav Kook's death. But the notebooks themselves were written between 1904 and 1914. So it seems that Rav Kook here is aiming a jab at contemporaries who, rather than concentrating on realizing their mission in life or the Jewish people's mission in life, were thinking about, you know, who's ahead and who's in charge and how to get one up on your neighbour in the social Zionist bureaucracy, rather than on what really matters. That's my sense. Katraga hayerech avda sivuv panimyota simchat chalka chalma al dava hadrat melachim chitzona. Now Rav Kook takes another well-known source, the Gemara in Chulin Daf Samach, as a yet another illustration of his theme. The Gemara in Chulin talks about how the sun and the moon were originally created equal. The moon was jealous of the sun, that
that the sun was just as bright as it was, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, fine, if you're jealous, if you're not happy with how I made you, then I'll make you smaller than the moon. That's the Midrash on the Pasuk, Shtei Me'orot HaGedolot. So, according to Rav Kook, the moon's problem, the moon's mistake, was exactly what he's been talking about this whole passage, not being happy with what it herself was supposed to be doing in the world, dreaming of what the sun was doing, not turning its attention from its own selfhood to somebody else's selfhood, and therefore was punished by being made small. V'kol holecha lam v'tzolel v'avdan ha'anish al kol echad shel ha'prat v'shel ha'klal. And so on and so on, that the whole world loses its selfhood, its individuality, both of the individual and of the collective. Now here's a passage which is challenging for Jewish educators. He goes on and says, Ba'im machanchim melumadim u'mistaklim b'chitzoniyut masichim dea gam min ha'ani u'mosifim teven al ha'madura mashkim et ha'tzmeim b'chometz ומפתמים את המוחות ואת הלבבות בכל מה שחוץ מהם. So he says, learned educators come along, looking at externality, and turning their attention away from the I, the self, presumably the self of the students, the people who are supposed to be learning. And in so doing, they add straw to the blaze, and it's as if they're giving thirsty people vinegar to drink. And they're fattening minds and hearts with everything that is external to it. So what Rav Kook here is saying that in his view, and concerning this problem which he's talking about, education can do more harm than good. Saying that educators are not concerned with the unique selfhood often of their students. They have their agenda, their curriculum, the things which they have to be learned for the standardized tests at the end of the year, and they just like stuff it into their students because that's the job that has to be done. And in that they're adding fuel to the blaze and just simply increasing the problem of alienation from the self. Now this raises a lot of questions, and I think we should say it's something about Rav Kook's views on education, and to put this in perspective. In Orot HaTorah, where he talks about education in the most sustained way, he says things which appear to be tending in different directions, if not contradictory. On the one hand, he has many statements are in the vein of what we've just read, that education should be about realizing the individuality of the student, that Torah education should be about connecting the student to his or her, well, Rav Kook says his, but we might want to say her today, particular Miktsoa in Torah. He talks a lot about the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, Le'olam Yilmod Adam B'Makom Shelevor Chafetz, that realizing one's selfhood through Torah and education is central to him. On the other hand, he also there has a lot of statements where he talks about the importance of knowing the Torah, knowing the basic things which an educated Jew, which a Talmid Chacham, ought to know. Says in detail, has to know Shas and Poskim, one should learn the Rif and the Rosh and the Rambam and the Rosh and Tosfot and the Gemara, one learns. In a famous letter to his son, he berates him for only going over the Gemaras he learned three times, and he says, if you don't go the Gemaras you learned at least 10 times, you certainly won't remember them. Ways in which he's very insistent on the centrality of traditional curriculum. How to put those together in practice? I don't know. I don't know if there's any Jewish educational
setting in the world which has done that, which has combined the emphasis on mastery of the basic sources on the one hand and scope for individuality and creativity on the other hand. I mean, that raises the question of, you know, whether there is a Jewish educational framework which does or could exist that honours the ideals which Rav Kook was talking about here of encouraging and enabling the students to connect to their unique individuality in some way. That's a question which educators themselves have to think about. You know, maybe, you know, it was only Ralph Cook. I mean, I don't like to think this, but maybe only Ralph Cook had sort of a breadth and depth and brilliance which enabled him at the one hand to master the basic all about the basic material, and at the other on the other hand to uncover his uniqueness and individuality. You know, I don't like to say that, you know, that he was only writing about himself, but it's a challenging question how these ideals can be realized and reconciled in practice today. So he says that educators often do more harm than good in the sense of alienating the students from their individuality, and he says v'ha'ani holech u'mishtakeach, the I carries on and continues to get more and more forgotten. The kevan she'ein ani, ein hu, and since there is no I, there is no he. The kal v'chomer she'ein ata, and all the more so there is no you. The Rav Kook's suggesting that if one isn't connected to one's own individuality and selfhood, it's very hard to recognize somebody else's, and even more so to recognize some other ata, some other you, someone who's standing straight in front of you. This was probably written before Buber's I Am Thou, but in any case, I don't think that I Am Thou was such a great chiddush that Rav Kook couldn't have thought of it beforehand. And the final paragraph of this piece, he starts to talk about the solution. Not, I'm afraid, in terms which are specific enough that you could actually put it into practice in a classroom, but suggesting the sort of concepts in Jewish thought and history which, in Rav Kook's view, go along with a solution to this problem. He says, Ruach apeinu, Mashiach Hashem. The breath of our nostrils is the Mashiach, the Anointed One of Hashem. So, a quote from Reicha Perek Gimel, I believe. And incidentally, in this chapter, which deals with individuality, there are at least three occasions which I've seen that Rav Kook brings this pasuk Ruach Apeinu Mashiach Hashem, central to what he's talking about here. Let's see what he means. Zehu Gvurato Hada Gadlo, Einenu Mivachutz Lanu, Ruach Apeinu Hu. Et Hashem Elokeinu v'David Malkeinu Nevakesh. He said, this greatness, this power which we're looking for, is not something outside of us, but it's Ruach Apeinu. It's as close to us, as part of us, as the breath of our nostrils. But what he's also saying, and I'm claiming this based on other passages here where the same motif occurs, is that in bringing the pasuk Ruach Apeinu Mashiach Hashem, that this individuality, connection to one's uniqueness, which he's looking for, is for Rav Kook a facet of Yimut HaMashiach. That part of what it means, in his view, to be approaching Yimut HaMashiach, is that more and more people will achieve this this sense of connection to their own uniqueness. There's also based on, on elements in Kabbalistic thought, in the Ari and the and Hasidic thought, particularly of Ishbitz, which is probably beyond the scope of this discussion to go into in detail now. But they also suggest that there's something messianic about this this idea of connecting to oneselfhood. Et Hashem ve'el tuvo nefached, of Hashem and His goodness we will be afraid. Et ha'ani shelanu nevakesh, we'll look for our selfhood. Et atzmenu nevakesh v'nimtza, and our individuality we will look for and we will find. Chaseh kol elokei necher, put aside strange gods. Haseh kol zar u'mamzer, put aside every stranger and mamzer. V'yadatem ki ani Hashem elokeichem, hamotzi etchem me'eretz Mitzrayim liyot lachem lelokim, ani Hashem. And here Rav Kook invokes, in the context of this talk of individuality, another fundamental motif in Jewish thought, the Torah, Yitzhak Mitzrayim, that knowing your ani and freeing yourself of whatever alien forces or influences which have prevented you recognizing this ani is somehow also analogous with Motzi Yitzhak Mitzrayim. That some of his commentary on the Haggadah, he makes this explicit, that for him an important dimension of what Yitzhak Mitzrayim means is going out from the things which had enslaved you inwardly and prevented you from being in contact with your own authentic self. It may even be, and I wouldn't want to definitely impute this to Rav Kook, that when you might want to edit off the tape, that when he quotes the end of the Pasuk, Ani Hashem, you know, maybe he's also saying that the element of the Ani that we're looking for is that which partakes somehow in godliness, which is something that mystics sometimes seem to say. It's also something which is a very controversial thing to say. Maybe Rav Kook is hinting at that, maybe not. I wouldn't like to put words into his mouth there. So, I've brought this text to show how central this idea was for Rav Kook. And this is a place where he says these things particularly clearly and forcefully, and connects them with his interpretation of some of the most essential Jewish stories of Adam HaRishon and the Chet HaVod HaZohar and Yitzhak Mitzrayim and Mashiach. They're all bound up with this for him. I could have brought scores of other pages in which Rav Kook says similar things, but this is a place where he says it particularly clearly. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that the reading and the commentary were very enlightening and good. I'd like to perhaps ask a few questions or make some comments.
Yeah.
He starts off with this Va'ani b'toch ha'gola. Which you correctly said is connected to Yechezkel, etc. But I think also Gola is a transitory term. It's not the end of time, right? That's not... Gola is an intermediary situation which has to end in some sort of redemption. That seems to be the bargain with our Kodesh Baruch. So when you say the Ani is B'toch HaGola, what I think you mean is I'm missing something, but I know that I'm missing it. I haven't gotten to the point where I don't even know that I'm missing something that I might have. And that he traces it back to these major events in Jewish history, like Adam and Chava getting kicked out of Gan Eden, the Chetan Egel perhaps, which is at least close to idolatry. And he says that that we have the capacity to lose touch with our true goal, which is to be as divine as possible, right? And therefore, there's no doubt that the Ruach HaPeinu Mashiach Hashem that he ends with is also a kind of a reference to the Ruach Memala law of Oculus, which sort of defines the human creation. So that in order for a human being to find the connection to God, the connection is not external, like you take a rope and you tie yourself to God somehow, which is more the mitzvah notion, like there's a rope, mitzvahs that tie you to God's will, so that could end up in, like you get very close with the rope, that could be called dveikut. But the Rav Kook is talking about a different idea, that since there's a divine within everybody, if you can discover that divine, so then in Mimela, you would be the ultimate kind of dvekus that is enabled, that is there for man. So that atzmiyut, or individuality, is for Rav Kook the key to that kind of discovery. Because whatever is inside of you, I mean, maybe it's similar to that notion that even the Rambam says at the end of Makos, that there's a sort of a mitzvah for everybody. That there's some mitzvah that each person could discover the mitzvah that he could do so well, connecting him to God's will, that he would get right into Gan Eden. Here he says that if you could discover yourself, which is a kind of a very appealing modern idea, since that self is really what God put into you, then that discovery would turn you into like a person who's focused on Kedusha and Tara, and not on anything that is foreign, which denies you your true essence. So that there's the religious personality has to discover who he is, and through that discovery find the Kedusha and the Tara. Which I'm not sure it's exactly the same. You asked about Talmud Torah and other things. I'm not sure the discovery is the same as saying I should spend my whole life doing that. I mean, I think that's a further decision. But if a person finds within himself something that he can call godly, like music or art, or it doesn't mean that on the tzibur level he no longer has responsibilities. I mean, just because he can live with his connection to God out in the desert someplace, doesn't mean that he should go out in the desert and do it, but that somehow you could fulfill both obligations, since he says that ultimately, he always says that somehow this notion which you can find in the individual has to be carried on to the tzibur. Like, there's nothing in Rav Kook which doesn't include the tzibur, but if every individual who discovers this Kedusha and Tara would leave the tzibur, that would not be good. So the Talmud Torah is, interestingly, even though it's an academic or intellectual subject, but on different levels, it creates a tzibur. It keeps the tzibur together. Whereas if a person says, look, I found it, I know my connection to Kedusha and Tara, I mean, I have my music, I have my art, or whatever, that he would be taking himself out of the tzibur and not making contribution. Now, even though I don't know exactly the minun, like how much of this and how much of that, but it seems that if you're an artist full-time, you have to still go to Daf Yomi or something. You have to have that. You can't say that you're not connected anymore, at least according to Rav Kook. I mean, the national side of religious development was very very significant.
I think you raise some very important important questions there.
you might put it by saying that the 19th century romantic ideal of the artist, which we started with, and which I think Ralph Cook was aware of and is in some ways referring to, was intensely selfish in many ways. And those people often couldn't care less about the tzibbur. The realizing their own uniqueness through art or poetry or whatever it was an overriding goal in itself. And the tzibbur came into conflict with that, and it was too bad for the tzibbur. That's you see in romantic writing, and probably which is an extreme in someone like Nietzsche. And so Ralph Cook is in some of the passages which we'll see, perhaps in this discussion, perhaps in other ones, Ralph Cook's intensely aware of the capacity for conflict between this ideal of self-revelation, perhaps through art on the one hand, and obligations to the tzibbur on the other. He would certainly agree that the artist has to go to Daf Yomi. And my impression is that he hopes and perhaps believes that this search for individuality won't come into conflict with any important Torah values if it's pursued properly and with purity of heart. But that's a question. I'm not so sure that his faith is always warranted. I think that it can, that kind of selfishness which is necessary to achieve excellence in art doesn't always go along with the way of life which is necessary to go to Minyan three times a day and Daf Yomi.
The same question you asked of the Rambam. The Rambam says first you have to learn the Havayas of the life of Rava, and then you learn philosophy. But if you learn philosophy, you go through that system. Mm-hmm. Like you're now a philosopher. You've learned Torah, Shabbat, Shabbat, and now you've learned philosophy. Mm-hmm. So, and your dveikus comes from philosophy. Mm-hmm. So why do you have to keep doing mitzvahs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right, but the Rambam, who I guess went through those stages, nevertheless felt that you had to keep doing mitzvahs, perhaps also as part of the tzibur, but you never lose your connection to the tzibur, even if the tzibur is not a mystical entity. Mm-hmm. Right? It is for a cook sometimes, but it's only a practical entity. Like in order to make sure other people follow you, you have to stay with them. Mm-hmm. So if you gave up mitzvahs or halacha for philosophy, then the people who are at the bottom of this project might give it up at an earlier stage, or it just won't work. Mm-hmm. If you have a sense of tzibur, if you're an individual who doesn't care, as you say, the romantic artist of one kind or another, then but in this case, is that the Rambam must have had the same problem as Rav Kook, and he solved the problem in a similar way.
He solved the problem by saying that philosophy is for the elite, and it's perhaps within the range of every individual to get there, but it takes an awful lot of work. It was Ralph Cook. I don't think it's always so clear who he's talking about. And who he's talking about is an important issue. Do you have to know Shas before you can get into this business of knowing your individuality? I mean, I think we would like to say that art and creative pursuits can be relevant to 10th graders in Ramaz. But is Ralph Cook talking about them, or would he? The demand for individual self-realization is very a very strong one in American culture. I mean, sometimes in debased forms, be true to yourself and be the best self that you can be. But Ralph Cook would say that there's a real spiritual demand there somewhere. But it's one which all American high school kids are familiar with, even though know, they might express it in terms of, you know, being...
But that's not a religious goal.
No.
That was a spiritual goal.
Right.
And so a social goal, don't be oppressed by the fact that your mother wants you to be at this, you could be at that.
Right.
But it's not as though you're saying that there's that individuality is where the creation of man is most, you're most aware of yourself as a creation of God. You discover the individuality that God put within you. That's a different sentence.
Right.
And not a sentence, as you said, that most artists and musicians would ascribe to it. They just want to be artists and musicians and earn a living.
Yeah. I agree. I think, as you say, it's a goal which high school kids are aware of, but they probably wouldn't identify it as a spiritual goal. And the question is whether the fact that at least Ralph Cook sees it as a spiritual goal provides an opportunity to engage them educationally through this ideal which they're in some sense aware of, or not, or whether in fact Ralph Cook wasn't talking about American high school kids.
Well,
there's
a variety of notions. And sometimes a positive educational method, you have 30 kids sitting in front of you, they're not all the same. And you have to offer them a variety of notions that might attract some or another group. So I think that that the idea that people, I mean today, Americans are all aware of the fact that, I would say Americans for example, or kids today are aware of the fact that they may have some talents. But they don't know what that means in the final analysis. They know whether they become doctors or businessmen or try to develop their talents, it's usually about money and not about value. Maybe this could kind of instruct them to, that there might be some other values that could be considered in making the decision.
It's also interesting that for Cook, the return to, and again this probably jives with the 19th century background and romanticization of the artist which you mentioned earlier, for Cook the return to the authentic inner I, the inner self, the output of that return, the result of that return is some kind of creative output, be it art, be it the plastic arts, literature, etc. Chidushe Torah, and that's certainly let's say Rabbi Soloveitchik's spin on the related discussion in the second half of his Yishalacha, for example. But some form of creativity, that if you've succeeded in finding your inner self without turning it into some kind of 12-step program, but if you've succeeded in finding your authentic inner self, so then that means you can now get on with it, and that is the creation of something, the creative impulse, and the artist will paint and sculpt, the author will write, the Talmud Chacham will generate Chidushe Torah. I wonder if in the contemporary sense the contemporary discussion which is so flavored with pop psychology and other modern notions of the self, I wonder if the return to the authentic I leads toward that creation, or if it's about finding some type of inner balance and happiness and peace of mind without the imperative to then, as I said, get on with it. To lakshim, to fulfill the definition of who you are, be it artist, author, or creator of Chidushe Torah. There are other examples we could fill in the blanks.
Right, you could add, you know, doctor or psychologist or someone else who's involved in doing in the world, but in some way reflects who they are. Yeah, I think you're right that this ideal exists in the world, and perhaps in American culture in particular, in a lot of different forms. I mean, in American culture, you probably trace it back to Emerson and Thoreau, who talk in similarly insistent terms about the ideal of, you know, self-reliance and becoming your own fullest self. And echoes of this in American culture down to, you know, the recruitment ad for the American Army, which says, you know, be all that you can be, and down to, you know, Coca-Cola ads, which say, you know, say that you're ads for different kinds of sneakers, which say that you're fulfilling your unique self by wearing the same sneaker and drinking the same soft drink
as everyone else.
Right. and I think pop psychology is also a variation on that. The fact that an ideal can be debased doesn't mean that there's not a real ideal there somewhere which could be recovered.
Maybe. Yeah. Just a comment again on the Talmud Torah versus individuality question.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, according to the system, even though Talmud Torah is intellectual and chidushim are difficult, but it always works. Right, you get up in the morning and you make a bracha, and then you read a couple of pages in the Siddur, say, Eizu Makoma, you did it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the other option is elusive. There's no guarantee that if you try to discover your inner self in a most profound manner, even if you have some indications like you're good in music or good in art, it doesn't mean that you will necessarily discover what Rav Kook is pointing to. There's no method. So mitzvahs are a terrific fallback position. Like, even if you don't discover God within you, you could at least be mekabel olma hushamayim, which will then give you a certain profit that you wouldn't get at all if you tried the other route. Unless you were totally successful. You're not going to get credit for doing etudes of the piano.
Mm-hmm.
You only get credit for being a holy and pure person through music. That's a speculative notion, and there's no guarantee that anybody is going to get there. You got a guarantee, basically.
Well, there's two points there. You mentioned a kind of normative. Brother Robin, do you mention a kind of normative function that Talmud Torah as an ongoing, someone's ongoing fulfillment of Talmud Torah can be measured in some kind of minimal way that they can say that they've done it? But I think if I understand correctly, Rav Kook here is talking not in terms of that normative sense, but pedagogically speaking. In other words, schools set for themselves, and we were discussing this earlier, schools set for themselves some kind of notion of what students ought to know. Now maybe that's a notion which needs to be re-examined, but that notion of the cookie cutter, the assembly line, that, well, students come pass through the school and they ought to know things. And schools generally are pretty good, more or less, at doing that, but in the process of fulfilling that, and there's no doubt that there are certain things that literate functioning Jews, literate functioning citizens of the world need and ought to know, might undercut the desire to foster individuality and that return to the inner eye. I'm not sure that schools are equipped to really generally, genuinely do that, to genuinely launch everyone on that mission to the inner self. But they are generally good at producing people who are competent and knowledgeable and know whatever the canon of knowledge, and perhaps to a certain degree possess certain beliefs, attitudes, etc. But in terms of launching someone on that the quest to find him or herself, perhaps it's necessary to, like the Rambam you alluded to, the progression, the curricular progression, that first there's certain things you need to know. There's lechem u'basar, there's certain things that a student needs to know before he can then begin processing and lomei davar mitoch davar and making applications and then trying to figure out what his own individual relationship to it is. I'm not sure.
It's a big question. And yes, you say Rabbi Robin raised 2 points. One is method and one is success. You know, if there's a method for Talmud Torah, is there a method for this search for individuality? And as we'll see in future discussions, Rav Kook doesn't have much to say about method, but he does have a little bit. You know, he does give you some clues about how you might go about doing this. But then there's the question of success. You know, you can follow the method, but you know, you might not get anywhere. You might, and that's, it's a big risk. Yeah, you're quite right in that. So Talmud Torah and mitzvot is a much safer route. So as far as the question of whether schools are equipped, very important issue. And as, you know, we've been suggesting that, you know, the arts, creative writing, may be a way in which schools can approach that. There's an opportunity for students to go off in a way which reflects their own individual way of seeing things. And maybe through an individual, you know, counselling and discussion between the students and teachers, if the school has the resources for that, students will have to figure out what they're good at. But my personal opinion is that actually schools can't avoid this. Can't avoid taking up this challenge. That one significant reason why, you may disagree, but why what I've seen Jewish education sometimes fails, whether at school level or at yeshiva level, is that students just don't feel that the whole thing engages with who they are in any significant way. It goes past them or over them or behind them or... But it's not, what does this have to do with, you know, with me, with my life, my interests, my talents, my me. And, you know, they could say that there's something selfish about that demand, something, you know, American and narcissistic. But Rav Kook would say, yes, but also there's something holy about that demand as well. That really education should...
Which might be.
Might be,
it
yes.
Might be holy.
Yeah. Yeah. But should...
It's narcissism, is that holy, I imagine?
No, but you could even say that's a debasement of what Rav Kook is calling for. But, you know, they could say, Rav Kook would say, yes, but in some cases there may be a holy impulse behind that demand. And we talked last time we spoke about Yael Unterman's article in the From All My Teachers book, and that seems to be basically what she's saying there. That, you know, for her, her education fell down because it just didn't seem to relate to her inner life in any meaningful sense. So I'd say that, yeah, I agree with you. It's hard. It's not obvious how high schools or yeshiva should do this, but I think in today's culture, I think they should have a go.
But no, I think my point was not that schools can't or shouldn't be doing this, but schools as conventionally conceived, you know, whose prime purpose is to pass over a certain body of knowledge. Mm-hmm. You know, our argument here, Atid, you know, is and has been to find ways to alter that model, to throw a monkey wrench into those works, mm-hmm. both curricularly, as well as to generate some opportunity for that that individual exploration, which may not always lead to creativity as defined here by Rav Kook. Because again, I'm not certain that the contemporary notion of what it means to be, that if we're correct, if we've read this correctly, for Rav Kook, returning to the real self leads to a creative impulse. I'm not sure that that's the way it's conventionally conceived, contemporarily conceived. It could be that Rav Kook's conception is a much healthier conception than the contemporary one, but I'm not sure. I think we perhaps hope to explore that in future discussions.
Yeah. All
right. I think perhaps we should end our discussion here, but it's really just the beginning to crack open this difficult topic. We hope to bring you further discussions and examinations of texts and ideas in this series, trying to figure out a meaningful role for creativity and the arts in religious life in general and in Jewish schooling in particular. We hope to make that available to you through our website at www.atid.org.
Thank you very much to Rabbi Bravender and Rabbi Sinclair.
I had Rav Kook, who was, his education was very traditional, and whose own personal contact was with people, his teachers, his mom.